Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A plan to change the way poultry giant Allen Harem handles wastewater from one of its processing plants has some Milton area residents worried about its possible impact on their drinking water.
It'll sink into our water aquifer and provide water to the wells. The wells will be contaminated. It's only a matter of time. How long?
Our Katie Pikus takes an in-depth look at the project and the questions it's raising. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We'll also hear from a national expert on the opioid crisis who visited the first state this week, and learn more about work on regulations to govern changes made to the Delaware Coastal Zone Act. Plus, a conversation with Delaware Supreme Court Justice Karen Vallejora. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Last legislative session, lawmakers passed a bill loosening Delaware's landmark Coastal Zone Act. The measure, signed into law by Governor John Carney in August, allows businesses to set up new heavy industry on 14 sites along the coast previously protected. But those businesses will be required to clean those sites up. The goal? To spur economic development and create jobs. But this change isn't happening overnight. The Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control needs to create new regulations setting conditions for the new industrial activity at those sites where industry already existed when the original law was passed. Recently, DENRAC held a pair of public meetings as part of its effort to reach out to stakeholders and create what DENRAC Secretary Sean Garvin has called a transparent process for writing these regulations. Our contributor John Hurdle attended one of these meetings and spent time checking in with those for and against the change to the Coastal Zone Act to see just how the process is going and the challenges it faces. John's piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org, and he joined me this week to discuss what he found. John, thanks for joining us on The Green this week.
Hi, Tom.
Well, the changes opening up the Coastal Zone Act to new development passed the state legislature relatively easily earlier this year, but that may have been, in fact, the easy part. Now DENRAC is trying to write the regulations that will govern those changes. How challenging has this process been so far? How challenging is it going to be?
Well, I think the first challenge, Tom, is that some opponents of the new law are still unhappy with it, even though it was passed pretty resoundingly by the legislature. And they made their opinions known at the first public meeting on the regulatory process last week. One advocate said she's concerned that allowing new heavy industry on the 14 coastal sites will increase the risk to public health. And another said she fears for the safety of her sailboat because of the increased number of ships that the new law would allow to visit the so-called bulk transfer facilities in the Delaware Bay. The meeting was the first step towards assembling what DENRAC calls a regulatory advisory committee of stakeholders, and they're designed to that panel is designed to guide the process of writing the regulations. Some critics of the new law worry that the panel is going to be dominated by business interests, or maybe even sidelined by DENRAC itself.
I was going to say, you know, this is a big piece right now. Is just trying to get you know, all the people who are supposed to be part of this process together to help move it along. Aside from these public meetings, what else has DENRAC been doing to kind of decide who's going to be part of this process and how far along are they in the process of pulling all these stakeholders together?
Well, you know, one of the items on DENRAC's list is to decide which stakeholders are going to sit on this regulatory advisory committee. What DENRAC will tell you is that these committees are commonly used to help them write regulations on various laws, but there's actually no common standard for who sits on the panel, how members are selected, or what role they play in the development of regulations. And those were all questions that were put before the public meetings that they've held so far. So there were the two public meetings, one in Wilmington and another in Delaware City. People were asked for their views on what stakeholder groups should be represented, whether members should be nominated or just selected by DENRAC, and whether the panel should draft regulations or just provide guidance on them. DENRAC hasn't said how many people will be on the panel or what interests they'll represent. but it has conducted preliminary interviews with representatives of about 24 potential panelists, including developers, lawmakers, environmental groups, and contractors.
And in your piece, you mentioned some environmental advocates are not participating in those interviews. Why is that?
They feel that they object to a degree of what they see as secrecy on the part of of DENREC, because the preliminary interviews were conducted anonymously, and these folks feel that that this is a part of a public process, and that's not an appropriate way to be conducting the interviews.
So they're a little bit concerned about the transparency piece of all this. You mentioned earlier some of the opposition, continuing opposition to the changes to the Coastal Zone Act. Are those opponents optimistic that they can have their concerns addressed through the regulatory piece of this process, even though they weren't necessarily addressed during the legislative part?
Well, I think some critics are concerned that community voices won't be heard, even if and when they're represented on the committee. One advocate at last week's meeting in Wilmington said that DENREC hadn't left enough time for public comment on a consultant's report that's going to be summarizing the issues raised at these public meetings. DENREC Secretary Sean Garvin clearly heard that criticism, and he's now extended the public comment period, giving people 11 more days to comment on that consultant report than he'd originally planned. You know, despite critics' concerns, Tom, I think it's worth noting that DENREC does seem to be doing its best take an inclusive approach to writing these regulations. I referred to last week's meeting as part of a collaborative process, and it asked participants to name additional shareholder categories that they think should be included.
And you mentioned that the community aspect of this. Just to clarify for people, the majority of these 14 sites that are kind of being reopened to development are in Newcastle County, correct?
Correct, yes. 13 are in Newcastle County and one is in Kent County.
And so really when you're talking about the communities, you're talking about trying to find folks in those various communities in Newcastle County. I know you mentioned in your piece you had the one in Claymont at the former Everest Steel Plant. There's some other ones there as well. They're trying to find ways to get those communities engaged, correct?
That's exactly right. And some advocates are actually arguing that there should be at least two additional public meetings at which members of communities that were outside of those where the meetings took place before, that is, those not in Wilmington or Delaware City, at which people there could be heard.
You mentioned talking to DENREC Secretary Sean Garvin. It seems, as you were saying, he's pretty aware of, I guess, the rough road ahead that he may face with getting this done, and that this is kind of an atypical regulation writing process, correct?
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, he's clearly aware of lingering opposition to the update to the law, and so he's saying that he's taking a more thorough approach to being inclusive this time than he typically does in writing regulations.
So what is next in this process to get these regulations written?
Well, the consultant that DENREC is using to conduct these public consultations, a company called the Consensus Building Institute, they're due to deliver a report on the meetings on December 23rd. And then the public is going to have until January 19th to submit additional comments for potential inclusion in the regulations.
And at that point, do they start to get down to the actual work of writing the regulations?
That's correct, yes. That's when the writing begins.
And obviously it's a process that could take some additional time. After that, all this needs to be done by October 2019, which does sound like it's far off. But when I talked to Sean Garvin at the bill signing for this Coastal Zone Act bill back in August, he conceded it's a pretty ambitious timeline. And it's something that certainly we'll keep an eye on. And certainly, I guess, John, we'll keep an eye on some of these opposition groups, because it does seem like it's a pretty wide spectrum of opposition that's still out there that's lingering.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. Again, his piece on the work to write regulations governing the change to Delaware's Coastal Zone Act is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And next up on The Green, science reporter Katie Pikus takes a deeper look into poultry giant Allen Harim's plans to partner with Artesian Water to change the way Allen Harim handles wastewater from its harbors and processing plant. Stay with us. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Milton area residents are pushing back on a plan that will stop poultry giant Allen Harim's Harbison chicken plant from discharging its wastewater into a Sussex County creek. The plan calls for Allen Harim to pipe its treated wastewater 8 miles to a facility northwest of Milton owned by water resources company Artesian Resources Corporation. The water will be stored at that facility and sprayed onto nearby land. But as Delaware Public Media's Katie Pikus reports, residents in the Milton area fear their wells will be contaminated, and they're calling for more study of the plan as Artesian begins construction on that new facility.
For decades, Allen Harim Foods' Harbison chicken plant has discharged treated wastewater into Beaver Dam Creek.
I mean, this is clean wastewater, and we could continue to do this. We absolutely could continue to do this.
Kathy Bassett is a spokeswoman for Allen Harim. Bassett says Allen Harim has fixed problems with excess nitrogen and ammonia in the Harbison plant's wastewater. But getting the wastewater out of the creek and onto land offers an opportunity for cleaner disposal, a more environmentally friendly solution. In a few months, Allen Harim will take advantage of that alternative. They'll send more than 1.5 million gallons of wastewater each day through an 8-mile-long pipe to a lagoon facility owned by Artesian. Artesian will store the water in a large lagoon and spray it onto agricultural lands and wooded areas in the Milton area. Joe Moran is Allen Harim's president and CEO.
We'll get out of the creek. A lot of people think you don't discharge in the creek. The connotation is, oh, that's bad for the environment. Well, you see there's nothing wrong with the environment that we're producing to today, but it's more advantageous to go to the fields. Field spray right now.
Last year, the state cited Allen Harim for harmful levels of pollutants in its wastewater between 2012 and 2016. Allen Harim says it's cleaned up its act since. And the company adds it was talking with Artesian about the planned wastewater project even before the state flagged those violations. According to Artesian's construction permit application, the wastewater Allen Harim will send to the facility can have high levels of nitrogen that aren't safe to drink. Artesian says it has determined how large an area needs to be irrigated to effectively lower the nitrogen levels of water reaching the soil beneath the spray fields to meet the drinking water standard. But some Milton area residents, like Paul Reed, say they worry the water sprayed onto the fields that will go into their wells won't be drinkable if Allen Harim's flow doesn't meet requirements.
If they can't meet the requirements, the stuff they send up here will be contaminated. And then it will get into the spray fields and it'll sink into our water aquifer and provide water to the wells. The wells will be contaminated. It's only a matter of time. How long?
Reed's well is less than 100 feet deep and about 500 feet away from one of the spray fields. He's nervous about what will happen to his well if Allen Harim doesn't fully treat its wastewater before it sends it through the pipe. But Artesian's chief financial officer and treasurer David Spaked says as Allen Harim's water moves through the pipe, Artesian will be able to see if there's anything wrong with it.
If we find that the treatment somehow isn't going as we expect it to, we have the ability to return that flow back to the facility for further treatment. And they have an on-site lagoon there themselves that will house up to 2 or 3 days worth of already treated wastewater that then they will have to take back through their facility.
He says Artesian has had no violations for water discharge in the 15 years they've been operating their wastewater systems. And they want to maintain that track record to assure the public they provide quality service. They operate a similar lagoon treatment facility in Middletown. But environmentalists aren't convinced. They say high nitrogen levels in drinking water can lead to numerous health problems, including cancer. Maria Payan is a consultant for the Socially Responsible Agricultural Project. She's been working with residents near Mount Air Farms' Millsboro chicken plant to resolve issues with well contamination. And she's helping Milton area residents fight Artesian's new wastewater facility, so what happened with residential wells near the Mount Air plant isn't repeated in Milton.
People depend on these private wells in order to provide their family with, you know, safe drinking water, safe water to cook, safe water to bathe, safe water to brush their teeth. Water is something that we take it so much for granted.
A grassroots group of Milton area residents is fighting for their wells. The group, called Keep Our Wells Clean, has filed an appeal with the State Environmental Board against Denrec Secretary Sean Garvin's decision for Artesian's facility to be built. The appeal highlights concerns from several residents who live close to the spray fields and believe they would be exposed to odors and possible contamination. Tony Scarpa is a Milton area resident and the co-founder of Keep Our Wells Clean.
We felt that the decision handed down by the Secretary of Denrec, Sean Garvin, was arbitrary and capricious. It will damage and will injure people that live in and around the area of the spray fields. We feel that there are environmental concerns that were not taken into consideration.
A public hearing hasn't been scheduled yet, and Scarpa says they're in it for the long haul. If they need to, they'll take the matter to court. In the meantime, Artesian and Alan Harim still need permits to operate the wastewater treatment site. If they get them, Artesian CFO Spaked says the facility will be operational in summer 2018. Katie Pikus, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Katie. And Katie was busy this week. She was also in Rehoboth, where a newly released archaeology study of remains found in that area sheds new light on part of Delaware's early 17th century history. Katie chatted with the Archaeology Society of Delaware's Daniel Griffith about what was found and what we've learned.
How did you come upon this discovery?
We were doing an archaeological survey in 1976 when I worked for the state as an archaeologist, looking for areas that may be affected by modern housing development or resort development that would damage the sites. So in 1976, we found a concentration of artifacts laying in a field that became the Avery's Rest site.
What were you originally looking for?
We were looking for any sites at the time. We were looking for, in 1976, any early historic sites, Indian sites, mapping them all and determining which ones needed further excavation based on whether they were threatened or not. The Avery's Rest site was not threatened in 1976. It was still farmed by the family, and so there was no further work there done until 30 years later in 2006 when a modern subdivision was planned for part of the site, and we began investigation to find out more detail about the site.
What was your reaction when you found this?
The reaction when we found the burials was, oh boy. The burials we were not looking for. We were tracking down a 17th century homestead. We were looking for houses, wells, refuse features that would indicate the kinds of artifacts or kinds of objects that the Avery family were using in the 1670s and early 1680s. And in the course of this excavation, we found the first burial. And that triggered a Delaware law that says I notify the state, and then we just consulted on what to do next.
And after that came the Smithsonian's involvement?
Yes, about 2 years after that. It took us one entire season of excavation to actually find all 11 burials because of the strategy that we were using. So we were very careful about uncovering in areas in order to locate the exact extent of the number of burials, both north, south, and east and west. That took us a year. So it wasn't until after that had been determined and consulting with the state, I was in touch with Dr. Owsley to determine whether the Smithsonian was interested in the recovery and the analysis, and they were. And so that took another 8 or 9 months for them to schedule a team to come over and for us to finish our excavation work around the burials. So it takes time. It's an all-volunteer effort. That's one of the most significant things, I think, on a sidebar story about the Avery's Rest Project is it's 95% all-volunteer, including myself, to do this work from the Archaeological Society of Delaware members.
So what was really the investigation process here? How did you go about your work from, you know, point A to Z?
Well, we first walked across the fields mapped in concentrations of artifacts. So we had a map of what the artifacts looked like on the surface. And then we began shovel test excavations and looking for any evidence of anything buried below the soil where it had been plowed. If we found things that were buried below, like cellar holes, wells, trash pits, graves, then we opened a larger area of excavation to find the limits of that and then begin test excavations in those, what we call features.
Can you talk about the significance of this discovery to Delaware?
The significance of this discovery is it's Delaware at this time was a frontier. When John and Sarah Avery moved here in 1674, the Dutch had been here off and on since 1631 in southern Delaware. But it wasn't until 1634 that the English firmly took control of this part of Delaware, and it became firmly an English colony from that point forward. It was a frontier in the sense that it was a toehold of Europeans and Africans on the North American continent, and it was multicultural. There were Swedish, there were Dutch, there were Finnish, there were African, and there were Native Americans living side by side in the 1670s, interacting every day. So it was really a multicultural frontier, and that was the beginning of Delaware.
What will your role in this be going forward as we continue to ask questions about the Avery family?
I'm continuing to do research on the archaeology side, while Dr. Owlsley and his team continues to do research on the osteology side and the bioanthropological side about the burials and what the burials can tell them from a scientific point of view. I'm going to be continuing with writing up the archaeology side, the kinds of artifacts that were found, the kinds of structures that were found, sharing this information with professional journals, professional presentations at conferences, as well as the general public like today.
And how will you work to educate Delaware about this part of history?
Certainly, anybody can pick up information and use it as they like. I think the State Division of Historical and Cultural Affairs has some plans for future publication or exhibits. It lends itself to that quite well. I'm sure the Smithsonian will do some things as it relates to the burials at some point in the future. And certainly, Dr. Owsley shared that he's working on a publication about life in early 17th century Chesapeake, including southern Delaware and these burials. So it'll be available that way as well.
Thanks to the Archaeological Society of Delaware's Daniel Griffith and our Katie Pikus for that conversation. And The Green continues in just a few minutes with another perspective on the opioid crisis around the country and here in Delaware, with a leading expert who's studied the crisis for over a decade. But first, your local news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The opioid epidemic has affected the nation, including Delaware, for more than 20 years now. Though recent state legislation has slowed the number of opioids prescribed in the first state, the number of suspected overdose deaths continues to rise. Nearly a dozen people died of suspected overdoses in Delaware over Thanksgiving weekend, and the number for the year locally stands at more than 220. Dr. Andrew Kolodny is co-director of the Opioid Policy Research Collaborative at Brandeis University's Heller School. Kolodny has been studying the opioid crisis for more than 15 years and worked for the New York City Health Department in the early 2000s as that city attempted to reduce overdose deaths there. He participated in an event in Delaware earlier this week, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino spoke with him about the progression of the opioid epidemic and its effect on the first state.
Starting in around 1996, the medical community begins hearing that patients have been suffering needlessly because we are too stingy with these drugs. We start hearing that the risk of addiction had been overblown, that addiction in patients prescribed opioids is very rare. We were even given the statistic that much less than 1% of our patients will become addicted. And doctors didn't just hear this directly from the drug company. If we had heard it directly from the drug company, we would have been less gullible. Beginning in the late 90s, we start hearing this from our professional societies. We start hearing it from experts in the field of pain medicine. We're hearing it from our hospitals, from our state medical boards. From every direction, we begin hearing that if you're an enlightened, caring doctor, you'll be different from those stingy, puritanical doctors of the past that were letting people suffer. You'll understand that opioids are a gift from Mother Nature, and they should be used much more for just about any complaint of pain. And as we responded to that campaign and the prescribing took off, it led to a sharp increase in opioid addiction. Since 1997, there's been a greater than 900% increase in the number of Americans addicted to opioids. And as the number of Americans with opioid addiction increased, opioid overdose deaths started to go up along with the increase in the number of people who are addicted. And so we're now facing an epidemic that includes soaring increases in infants born opioid dependent. It includes a flood of heroin and fentanyl into non-urban areas across the country. It includes an impact on the workforce, outbreaks of injection-related infectious diseases. We are dealing with the worst drug addiction epidemic in United States history.
To your mind, what needs to change in both how we prevent people from being prescribed opioids when they don't need them or when there maybe are alternatives to opioid prescription, also in seeing that people who are addicted to opioids receive quality care?
Yeah.
Or have access.
What you're asking me about is what has to happen in order to bring our opioid addiction epidemic ultimately to an end. The epidemic is not going to come to an end unless we can prevent more people from becoming addicted. And that will only happen if the medical community, including dentists, begins prescribing much more cautiously. Opioids are very good medicines for easing suffering at the end of life, and they can be helpful sometimes when prescribed after major surgery for a couple of days. But when they're prescribed aggressively for either minor injuries or minor surgery, or when patients are put on them long term for common problems like low back pain, they are much more likely to harm the patient than help the patient. So we need to really change the way these medicines are being prescribed if we hope to end the epidemic. I will say that even if we're able to achieve that, even if we can get the medical community to be much more cautious in its use of these drugs, we do still have millions of Americans now who are addicted to opioids. And their opioid addiction is not going to get better simply because doctors are becoming more cautious. If someone's opioid addicted and they're going to need to keep using, or they're going to be feeling very sick. And so if they can't get pills, more people will probably continue switching to heroin. So we have to see, for the millions of Americans who are now opioid addicted, we have to see that effective treatment, addiction treatment, is easy to access. It has to be very easy to access. Regardless of your ability to pay for it, on the same day that you would want treatment, you should be able to get it. It's got to be easier to access than it is to access heroin, fentanyl, or painkillers. Unless you make it easier to access, people will continue using. And when I talk about effective addiction treatment, I'm not really talking about detox or rehabs. Detox and rehab, you know, those modalities don't work well for most people with opioid addiction. The most effective treatments are long-term outpatient treatments with a medicine like buprenorphine. Another name for buprenorphine is Suboxone. And for people with very severe addiction who don't respond to buprenorphine, methadone maintenance is also a good option. People have to be able to access those treatments more easily than heroin, fentanyl, or painkillers if we want to see overdose deaths coming down.
You spoke to cultural changes in the medical community that would help to end this crisis. There have been some measures recently here in Delaware, in the state, and of course, the federal government, President Trump, declared it a national health emergency. What role do you see state and federal entities playing in this to do their part?
Well, there is a lot of good work being done on a state and county level. I think almost every state in the country and many counties across the country have a task force focused on the prescription opioid heroin crisis. These are task forces that have representation from the medical community, from law enforcement, state legislators. There's a lot of great work being done on a local level, particularly with expanding access to naloxone or Narcan to reverse opioid overdoses. Despite some really good efforts on a community level and on a state level, our opioid addiction epidemic is still getting worse. States and counties are not able to solve this on their own. We need help from the federal government. And unfortunately, this is a problem that the federal government has really neglected. President Obama, when he came into office in 2008, the opioid addiction epidemic was already severe. And it got worse every year that he was in office. But President Obama didn't start speaking about the opioid addiction epidemic or seeking any funding from Congress to address it until his very last year in office. And it was very late, and it was very little that we got from the Obama administration. President Trump, on the other hand, has been speaking about the epidemic quite a bit. He campaigned on the opioid addiction epidemic. Members of his administration speak about it frequently. And he even designated the problem a public health emergency. So we are getting quite a bit of talk from President Trump on the opioid crisis, but we've yet to get action from the administration. What we haven't seen from the Trump administration is a detailed plan on how the administration intends to tackle the problem. And we've yet to have President Trump seek funding from Congress to address the problem. I believe that we're going to need to invest billions, perhaps $6 billion a year over the next 10 years, or a $60 billion commitment over the next 10 years, if we want to make sure that people who are suffering from opioid addiction in the United States have access to effective treatment regardless of their ability to pay for it. This epidemic is costing the nation tens of billions a year, and so it's time to start investing in tackling the problem.
What role should law enforcement play? There's been a lot of criticism of the war on drugs, but it's still an illegal substance. And what role, to your mind, should law enforcement play?
Yeah, well, the war on drugs rightly has a bad reputation, because I think the war on drugs contributed to mass incarceration. And what the war on drugs really meant in many cases was a war on drug users and on people with addiction. I think in recent years we are seeing a change in attitudes about addiction from law enforcement. Even conservative politicians, when they talk about the opioid addiction epidemic these days, many of them start off by saying, we can't arrest our way out of this. It's great that we're hearing this. We didn't hear it in the past very much, when we had addiction epidemics that disproportionately hit low-income inner-city communities. What we got from policymakers was a war on drugs and a message that we could potentially arrest our way out of this problem. Yeah, so we're not hearing that today. What we're seeing is a much more compassionate response and a better understanding that addiction is a disease that needs treatment rather than a moral failing. There is, however, an important role, I believe, for law enforcement. I think we do need law enforcement to help us make heroin, fentanyl, and black market prescription opioids much more difficult to access. It's very hard to get people engaged in treatment for opioid addiction if they have easy access to opioids. If somebody who's opioid addicted can march into a pill mill office and walk out with hundreds of tablets of oxycodone, it's going to be very hard to engage that person into treatment. And that's going to be someone who's going to be at very high risk for an overdose death. Same thing if someone can easily walk to the street corner and buy cheap heroin or fentanyl. Those are going to be people that are going to be much harder to engage in treatment and are going to be at much greater risk of an overdose death. So you need a balance where law enforcement helps us make illicit and prescription opioids harder to access, while at the same time we're working to make treatment easier to access. It's through that balance that I believe we'll be able to see overdose deaths start coming down if we get it right.
Thanks to Dr. Andrew Kolodny, co-director of the Opioid Policy Research Collaborative at Brandeis University's Heller School, and our Nick Shalino for their time on The Green this week. And we close out this week's show next with Enlighten Me and a conversation with Delaware Supreme Court Justice Karen Vallahura about the state of women in the legal world. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. We turn to legal matters to finish out the show. Delaware was one of the last states, if not the last state, to admit women to its state bar. Delaware first admitted a woman in 1923. Only Alaska may have taken longer. There's conflicting accounts on who was the first female lawyer there. And Delaware didn't have its first female judge until 1971. The first state has made significant strides since then, but the conversation about increasing the role of women in the legal system, especially in leadership positions, continues. For this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele sat down with Delaware Supreme Court Justice Karen Vallahura, who was sworn in as a justice in July 2014. Last month, she took part in the National Women in Litigation Conference in Philadelphia. That conference, sponsored by the American Bar Association, had the theme Leading for Success in the Courtroom, the Judiciary, and in the Profession. And Justice Vallahura says it discussed in depth women leading in the federal and state courts, as well as the advancement of women in those areas.
All right, Justice, you were part of a panel discussion in Philadelphia, consisting of judges from around the country, federal and state courts involved. Talk a little bit about that discussion and what took place.
Yes, the discussion was really focused on talking about the progress women have made in litigation. And our particular panel was comprised of judges, and we were providing the audience with an overview of statistics of kind of where women sit as a percentage of the various benches in the jurisdictions in which we sit. And so it was kind of interesting to hear the numbers. And what I did was provide the landscape of where we are in Delaware as far as women occupying positions on the benches in Delaware.
I think people would be shocked at the numbers. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, let me just say, as a percentage of women in the Delaware bar, if you look at it over time, for members who have been in the bar 40 years and more, the number of women is only 3.2%. Right now, for the newer members who have been members 10 years and less, it's about 41%. If you look at our two primary business courts, the Delaware Court of Chancery and the Delaware Supreme Court, there have only ever been two women to ever sit on the Court of Chancery. One was Carolyn Berger, who sat from 1984 to 1994, and there have only ever been two women to sit on the Delaware Supreme Court. One was Carolyn Berger, who went from the Court of Chancery to the Delaware Supreme Court, and I am the second one. But to give you a little bit of historical overlay, Kelly, while Delaware is the first state, and we were the first state to ratify the U.S. Constitution, we were one of the last states, if not the last state, to admit women to the bar. And so women weren't allowed to become a member of the bar in Delaware until 1923. And so the first woman ever to become a judge in Delaware was in 1971, rather. That was Roxanna Cannon Arsht. And she was the fifth member of the bar in 1941. And when she got out of law school, she couldn't even really find a paying legal position and ended up working as a master in family court for 9 years unpaid. And finally was made a family court judge in 1971.
Justice Vallahura, you were sworn in as Justice of the Supreme Court in July of 2014. In your opinion, what can women in the bar, what have you done as a judge to help others? And I'm sure there are lots of other things that can be done.
Well, I think participating in programs such as this was a national conference, and it was attended by over 360 people, I think helps keep the issue in the forefront. And I should say that some progress has been made. If you look at some of the other courts, Kelly, the Superior Court, for example, if you look back in 1997, 12% of the women on the bench were members of the bench were women. Now it's 33%, 7 of 21 judges, and the president judge is a woman. That's Judge Dan Jordan. The family court is sort of an anomaly. Currently, 65% of the bench is comprised of women judges, and that's up from 38% in 1997. And so you raise a good question. I think you have to kind of look at why are the numbers so low in certain areas. And I think having been in the corporate litigation trenches for 25 years when I was in private practice, part of the explanation may be there were very few women in that area. In the early 1980s, there were probably, 10 or a dozen women who were doing that kind of corporate litigation full-time. Now the numbers are much higher, and in fact, there is a women's networking group that has been formed to help them develop their business in the Court of Chancery. We did have an interesting discussion about how to promote the newer members of the bar and provide them with litigation experience so that they can rise through the ranks. And the federal judges have really done a number of interesting things in terms of issuing standing orders that really encourage the participation of newer members of the bar. In fact, there's a compilation of them at www.nextgenlawyers.com. And you can see what they are doing. And so I think some of it is just women coming through the ranks. But frankly, women tend to drop out of private law firms at every level faster than men do. And I'm not sure why. I think that's just a statistical fact.
Where do we go from here for women listening who are interested in the law, for little girls who are, thinking about getting into the profession? What advice do you have as Justice of the Supreme Court?
I would encourage them to pursue their dreams, because I think the atmosphere now is far better than even when I entered the profession back in the late 80s. And there are many opportunities. I think for individuals who work hard, and I still believe in the American dream, frankly. And I think if you work hard and plow forward, you can do just about anything you want to do. Now, one of the things we did is talk about how often women appear before the Delaware Supreme Court, Kelly. That was kind of an interesting discussion. And it really arose from an article that a former federal judge, Shira Scheinlin, had written in the New York Times that was published on August 8th, 2017. And she was talking, the name of her article, the title of her article, rather, was Female Lawyers Can Talk Too. And she was talking about a recent New York Bar Association report that said the number of women attorneys appearing in speaking roles in court was found low at every level and in every type of court in New York. And she found that women lawyers were the lead lawyers in private litigation between private parties barely 20% of the time. And she also noted low participation in big bet the company type of civil corporate cases. And so one of the things I did informally, we don't normally track this sort of thing, but we looked at the number of women appearing before the Delaware Supreme Court over the last several years, and it hovers between 32 and 37% of the cases are being argued by women. And it would be my perception that we didn't break it down by case type, but the public bar comprises probably a bigger portion than women arguing corporate cases. The Delaware Attorney General's Office, for example, has 56% of its lawyer complement comprised of women lawyers, and the Delaware Office of Defense Services has about 34% women. And we see them frequently arguing cases before the Delaware Supreme Court. It's a little bit more rare to see women arguing the big corporate cases, although there are certainly some. And and they're prominent women doing such cases. So I don't really know what the explanation is, but it is better than it was. That's all I can say.
Are cases, Justice, overseen by women argued differently?
I don't think so. In my experience, I never discerned a difference between a woman's approach to arguing a case versus a man's approach. That's not something that I noticed.
Anything else from the conference in Philly yesterday that stood out for you?
I think just the tremendous support among members of the bar. It was well attended. The tremendous openness of the panel members in discussing how they got from point A to point B in their careers, and really the kind of reaching out and offering to help those coming along to do what we can to help them get to the next stages of their career. And that's, I think, something that women judges can do is be present, offer your advice and support to the people. Of course, we have to be fair and impartial, and we encourage all new lawyers to get good training and experience. But it was really, I think, a very positive kind of conference, and I think Delaware's progress was noted.
Thanks to Delaware Supreme Court Justice Karen Vallejo and R. Kelly Steele for enlightening us this week. And that's a wrap on The Green for this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor John Hurdle, Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Katie Pikus, and Kelly Steele. For them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.